Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a thought-provoking episode of the Son of a Pitch podcast. Today we delve into the depths of human experience, cultural dynamics, and the pursuit of personal fulfillment. Our guest is none other than Robert Greene, a remarkable individual whose unique journey has shaped his understanding of the world. In this captivating conversation, I engage Robert in a dialogue that uncovers the intricacies of cultural norms and the challenges faced by first-generation immigrants. Robert fearlessly shares his experiences, shedding light on the tendencies towards social norming and the need for individuals to prove their worth in certain contexts. But it doesn't stop there. As the conversation unfolds, we witness Robert's distinctive approach to decision-making and his ability to find structure within chaos. His strategic thinking and willingness to embrace uncertainty showcase the mindset of an entrepreneur who dares to pave his own path. The exploration doesn't end at entrepreneurship because Robert opens up about the importance of self-worth, the struggle with control, and the pursuit of happiness. His ability to thrive within a lonely space, coupled with his resilience in the face of challenges, offers valuable lessons for us all. So join us as we embark on a journey through Robert Greene's mind, a mind that challenges conventions, finds beauty in chaos, and reminds us that today is just today. So prepare to be inspired, enlightened, and captivated by this conversation that transcends the ordinary. It also transcends the shittiness of Zoom because this is the only recording I was actually able to find of our conversation, and it is far from high quality. But I thought it was important enough to share because this man is inspiring. It was recorded on December 15th, 2022, and I hope you guys enjoy it. So, I mean, you and I have known each other for quite a while.
Yeah, how long ago has it been?
Very long ago. Longer than I want to admit, because that makes me feel older, if you know what I mean. We've seen each other around the neighborhood, hung out a lot. Yes.
Yeah, it's been I guess probably.
Right? No, when we start thinking in terms of decades, I think we can just leave it be.
Yeah.
Right?
It's been long, yeah.
But I've known you from back when Hunger and Thirst was actually first starting. And this Hunger and Thirst I'm mentioning is because it was your baby. It is still your baby, right? Tell me.
Yes.
What, let's start with this. Who are you, Robert Greene?
Well, that's a good question. It gives me a moment to reflect me. Who am I? Who am I? Well,
who are you?
I'm a person made up of different things, different aspects, different characters. But in the core, I think that I can say that I am what you see. And I am, if we communicate, I am that person. I know I can come across to others also in many different ways. But hopefully most of the times they take the time to get to know me. And I can arrogantly say that most times, if it's negative, they often, almost always adjust their way of thinking and how they perceive me. Yeah.
Has it ever happened when people start off with a negative preconception?
Yes, definitely. And I'm very much aware of that as well. People often or sometimes find me arrogant, which I understand.
Really? Why? Is that a cultural thing? Like are you Dutch arrogant or are you New York arrogant?
Well, I think a mix of both and even a bit of Caribbean as well. I mean, people often find me arrogant when we take the time to this book to talk about it, actually, then it's because of the fact that I'm not a person to come across as very insecure. Do I? Yeah. I have my insecurities. I have an opinion of, I have an opinion about everything that concerns me, and I am very cautious and about my boundaries.
Is that sometimes controversial? Does that push people the wrong way sometimes?
Yeah, sometimes, because I mean, definitely I've heard it as a kid growing up. I've heard so many times people tell me, you're manipulative, but it's words that people just use, you know. And then again, if we choose to have a conversation, then it comes down to me setting my boundaries. And if you ask me a question, or can you help me with something, I would always think about it. I would always say, well, if I'm not sure, give me a minute, let me think about it before I say yes or no. Because if I say yes, it's a yes. And sometimes I say no. And then, yeah, that's often, or sometimes can cause people to be quite surprised because they don't expect you to say no. And then they would be like, well, you seem to be very, a bit egoistic or something. And I would try to explain, well, first of all, if you ask me a question, I have the ability to say yes or no.
Right.
Otherwise, I think you should rephrase that and just tell me what you want me to do.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, that's one example, for example, about how sometimes people find me arrogant. I know that I often can come across as if I'm very well secure about everything, self-secure. But I have my doubts sometimes. But again,
do you think that's a bad thing?
Definitely not for me.
Right?
It works for me, so it's not a bad thing for me. No.
But where do you think that comes from?
Well, I know where it comes from. It comes from my upbringing. It comes from my mom. It comes from my dad. And simply because they've always, my mother, especially, she always literally, it was an obligation to always think about what you wanted and what you like or what you didn't like, down to a little example. If she would ask you, just an example, what flavor ice cream you wanted, and you would say, well, it doesn't matter, she would never take that as an answer.
Really?
Yes, literally. Yeah.
So it doesn't matter is not a, you need to make a decision.
Yes. And you just had to think about it and indeed make a decision. And even those kids, you would then say something, whatever, because you know that she let you be. But it did teach me actually to always question what I want, what I dislike, what I like. Yeah.
So it kind of made you more, it sounds like it made you more decisive about, and then that rubs people the wrong way sometimes, I guess?
I can honestly say yes to both questions or both remarks. Yes. It makes me very decisive.
Yeah.
If I always think about things, always, with anything and everything that I do or plan to do, I always think about it.
And what was the thinking behind the foundation that you started a while ago, Hunger and Thirst?
Yeah, it was more like when I was going through my cancer treatment, when I started my cancer treatment, actually, I encountered taste alteration during my first chemotherapy.
So your taste changed?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
And that was a terrible experience. The first time I experienced it, it was just terrible. And I've worked in the health field. I've worked also in an oncology department years ago. And I was just not aware that this happened or could happen with patients going through chemotherapy.
So you were in oncology, in the cancer space.
Yes, years back.
Before you got cancer yourself.
Yes, yes.
And then you got it, and then your taste changed.
Yeah. And that drove me to first go on the internet and see if I could find research concerning taste changes. There was not much that I could find at the time. That's back in 2012. And I just felt that I wanted to do something about it. And instead of, well, you could do two things, actually. Complain about things sometimes or just try and change it. And trying to change it or trying to do something about it does not mean that I start off thinking and being convinced that it would be successful. But the fact that I just wanted to try something, try to do something about it. So that's why the organization started.
What was the point of it?
It was not to find a solution for taste changes, but it was to find a way to give support, knowing the emotional stress that it caused and causes So it was definitely not, I did not set out to find a solution to taste alteration. Mm. It was to see how you can give people support, and also especially to teach the people, the carers for patients, for their loved ones, to give them at least some know-how about taste changes, the impact that it has. Yeah.
Because there's quite a lot, at least in Europe. What is it, like 3 or 4 million people every year get diagnosed with cancer and then have to go through different forms of treatment, different kinds of therapies, right?
Yes, it's a lot. And you mentioned a number. I'm not going to dare go up there because of time. My memory is terrible. But it is a lot, and it will grow. The number is going to keep growing. If we look to 2030, 2050, the number is going to keep growing drastically. So, and 2 out of 3 people having chemotherapy suffers from taste changes.
Shit.
Yeah.
And so your ambition was to sort of give them the chance to enjoy food again, I guess? Or was it more the support side of things? Was it more the, we got you?
Yeah, it was a bit of both. And when you say to help to make people enjoy food, I wouldn't want to go out there with that limb. It's
no.
Again, trying to find ways to help people deal with the problem. And as I put it in the beginning when I was developing the concept, to create the beautiful memories. So it could be that not even enjoy the meal itself, but surrounding yourself with people who make you feel happy. And then the food, the fact that it tastes bad may probably take a little step backwards. So
it's more about the moment.
Yeah, trying to be creative with that, but also very much what was important is also create an awareness, like I said, for the people around the patient or the person going through cancer, because it is difficult for them as well. It's just, you can imagine if someone is creating a dish or cooking and you think, well, this person is sick, so I want to do something really great and wonderful. And then you give it to the person and they say, well, I don't like it, it tastes terrible. And then you probably ask, what do you want me to make? And you make something else. It's like, oh gosh, this tastes terrible as well.
Sounds like you're talking to my 3-year-old.
Well, so you know what I mean.
Right. Was it when you started the foundation itself from like a entrepreneurial perspective, from a business, have you had many? So you were in oncology before. Was that your first venture, if you will, that you've gone through, or have you done anything else that's similar, like in an entrepreneurial sense? Or
yes, I left the hospital and then went into IT in marketing and sales and worked.
Why would you do that to yourself?
Because I loved it. Well, I love marketing and love sales.
Oh yeah.
yes, still do. And when I left my last job, I always love looking at so-called problems and coming up with solutions. And back in the day when I was much younger, I would like take a piece of paper and write things down, like create some kind of a concept, and then I would throw it away because I would be like, it's just a feeling of coming up with an idea that probably can solve a problem. So when I started left the last job I was working at, I started an organization called Me Too. Meet and then social, unconventional, and exciting. And it was focusing on professional and social networking.
Me Too.
Meet Sue.
Meet Sue. Okay, not yes. Me Too.
No, Meet Sue.
That would be
Sue.
A terrible hashtag to own.
Yeah.
No, we're all going to get together and hashtag Me Too.
Me Too.
Yeah, just follow the hashtag. You'll find us. No.
No, let's not do that.
Let's not do that.
Yeah.
Meet Sue. Okay.
Meet Sue. Social, unconventional, and exciting. And
right.
Our motto was taking the work out of networking. And I am, I'm passionate about networking. I love networking. But what I say is I don't like networking in the traditional way. Traditional is like having a business card, giving a business card to someone when you have no idea who they are, et cetera.
Right.
Or asking for a business card even when you have no idea who the person is. business, actually. So I did that, and then actually, I think probably the same year when FA started me too, I started The Unknown, and that's a fashion, art, and music focused platform. Still online, but I don't do anything with them actually because of the fact that I've spent all my time almost in the charity on the first. Started another created another concept, started a platform also called Traffic Aid to help people in need. Started RealCamp Business Development to coach entrepreneurs and in a manner that I often see people trying to learn things that is very for them quite difficult. And I usually tell them, why not find the try the easy way out? Let's find someone you can collaborate with who's very good at what you want, you're trying to learn. And in the meantime, you release all the pressure in trying to get there and focus on what you're very good at.
So there's this like ongoing theme, if I correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like there's this ongoing theme of helping and connecting people. In almost every one of the ventures you've mentioned, there's an element of making people's lives, the quality of life for people a little better, or making things easier or more enjoyable for them, or even just on a fundamental level, connecting people of shared interests or shared experiences. Does this have, and then yet this is a stark contrast from how we open this conversation about people considering you, your decisiveness being abrasive and arrogant. I'm adding the abrasive bit, but just their perception of arrogance when ultimately the things that you're talking about revolve mainly around bringing people together. Why are those two different conditions? Like, why do those two things exist in the same Robert Greene space?
Well, I think honestly speaking, it's built up a number of things. I would not, for example, at a meeting, I would be silent until I have something to say.
Okay.
And when I do have something to say, I create an atmosphere where I know everyone will listen. And just to the silly.
What does that mean? You walk around with like smoke bombs and.
No, but if I start speaking and someone interrupts me, I would pause for a second and probably say, "May I continue?" And that can come across at times as being arrogant.
I guess. I mean, I do the similar thing. The first time someone interrupts me, I kind of just pause, let them finish their thing, and then I jump in afterwards, and I'm like, if it happens again, I'm like, are you finished? Can I say that?
Yeah.
So I can empathize. Where do you think that comes from? Is that because you spend quite a lot of time in the States as well, right? Or
no.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. You're from the Caribbean.
I was born in the Caribbean, St. Kitts, beautiful island.
Amazing. I was
British, so I'm also British. My father was American, but not born in the U.S. So lived in St. Kitts until I was probably 12, something like that, 12, right. 13. As I often say, we were always sent off during the summer holidays, at 3 months summer holidays, so we were always sent off the island to somewhere else.
And camp or family or?
No, family abroad. Okay. Yes. My connection with the U.S., has always been there, of course.
Yeah.
I was removed to Curacao, and because my mom was born in Curacao, but my grandparents were British.
Okay.
And lived there for about 7 years, 7.5 years. And then there was this decision that I had to make, either move to the US to study or move to the Netherlands. My sister and I have one sister, we've always been very close, and she wanted to move to the Netherlands and did not want to go to the US.
Why?
I have no idea, actually. I should ask you sometimes.
Why did you want to go here? Where would she have moved in the States? Where would you have gone in the States?
I would have gone to Ohio.
Oh my God. Why?
Yeah.
I mean, Ohio sounds lovely.
No, I found a college there, actually, that I was going to go to and study business psychology. That was what I wanted to do. But it all turned out wonderful and really great because of the fact that I did not have a scholarship or anything like that. My dad was the person who was going to cover all the costs.
Yeah.
And he died actually just a couple of, quite close to the time that I would have had to go to the U.S.
Mm.
So if I did go to the U.S., it would have been a problem. Imagine being in the U.S., not having any scholarship and literally from abroad going to be paid everything yourself. So it was a wise decision that I followed that did not and not go to the U.S. Yeah.
Was that an intense moment? Did that influence your decision of where to go?
No.
No?
No. No, definitely not. Like I said, I had a very close relationship with my sister, still do, actually.
Yeah.
And my life would not be what it is if I did not go, if did not come to the Netherlands. So I don't look back and have regrets because I base all the decisions that I make and have made on the knowledge that I had there, literally. So I don't look back and have regrets.
And being in the Netherlands, what makes it so, you think it's a good climate for the kind of stuff that you like to do? Or because you have in the past few years, you've, you know, started and run and launched some pretty impressive ideas and entrepreneurial ventures. Do you think this would be different if you were in the States, or is there something about the Netherlands? Like, is there something in the water?
Well,
you know, what is it?
Oh gosh.
Or is it you? It
could honest answer. When I was working with Mitsu, the networking platform, I was also developing concepts within Mitsu. And I went to the U.S. I went to New York, stayed there a month and had meetings, etc. And in that month, I actually achieved much more than I had achieved here in the Netherlands. So my personal experience is that in the Netherlands, I find it quite difficult being an entrepreneur or starting a new business or something. So that's my experience that I had in the US, in New York. I found people more willing to listen.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you run into moments where people just don't listen here?
I run into moments where I have to, and that's very often, I have to be very careful with how much information I give.
Why?
My first experience when I started developing concepts was with an agency, a quite known agency in the Netherlands, that told me that they wanted me to develop a concept because they wanted to improve their networking events for entrepreneurs.
Okay.
I developed the concept and everything. It included also how they should change their website, etc. And then I had a signed agreement that it was signed off via email. And then they said, well, we decided we're going to do it differently. I did go to the event, and literally everything that was in my concept, they had copied.
Oh, shit.
So that was my first encounter that I thought, Robert, you should be aware and be careful of what you're the amount of information you're giving. And that has happened.
Yeah, but is that a Dutch thing? Because it just sounds like it's just a douchebag thing, and there are douchebags everywhere, right?
Well, I'm not saying it's a Dutch thing, but that's my experience.
Right.
Here in the Netherlands.
Well, you also said it's difficult to start something here versus in the States. Why is that?
Well, the thing is,
at least for you, you said it was difficult.
Not really difficult. It's, I think for me, it feels different. And not only, let's say, I don't want to use the US as the example.
Because, no, it's a good example.
But for example, Mitsu, right? Mitsu was more in contact with the companies abroad in the US mainly. With Hunger and Thirst starting the foundation, I remember one of the first encounters that I literally had with someone when I reached out to a hospital, and the contact person there literally sent me an email and said, well, who are you to even think that you could do something on taste alteration? Well, that was literally what the person communicated. Yeah, I'm very serious. So
what were they looking for? Was that sort of like, who are you in the sense of?
Well, they just assumed that I had no healthcare background. They just assumed that, I guess afterwards, well, I can honestly conclude that they thought that I would be stealing their market. So I, after having that encounter, also had an encounter with another charity organization, because I think I was a bit naive thinking that all charity organizations, we all want to help each other, etc. I'm as honest to say, I don't think that way anymore, unfortunately. I had another encounter, and then I just started, I thought, you know what, let me just leave the Netherlands for what it is and just focus on internationally. And that's what we've been doing.
And so this move towards a more international focus, has that changed the way you behave here? Has that changed the way you engage with people and organizations here in the Netherlands or in Europe? Or is, like, to what extent, I guess what I'm really asking here is, to what extent does exposing oneself to a different context, in this particular case, an international one, influence the way you are, quote unquote, at home here in your home base?
That's a good question. I don't think I can actually answer that correctly, because
you can give your opinion. There's no real right answer, right?
I never actually set out thinking with anything I was doing, I'm focusing on the Netherlands. I've never done that. And these experiences that I just mentioned, they just happened.
Right.
I just had assumed that reaching out to organization in the Netherlands would have been much easier. But I find it much easier to reach out to organizations outside of the Netherlands. That works better, faster. Mm. So I've just kept doing that.
And why do you think that is?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Because you reach out to them, you present your case, if you will, for all intents and purposes, you make a good argument about why you can help.
Yeah, I don't know. As a charity organization, we collaborate with pharmaceutical companies, focusing on oncology, and we 99.9% of the contacts we have is always with the global offices. And then once we have contact with the global offices, we at times look at the national offices, and also, for example, in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
But primarily, the collaboration we have is with the global offices. Maybe that just works out much better for me. Don't know.
Interesting.
So what do you think?
I think, and so in this space, I like this sort of thinking, I'm just going to come out and say, I think it works for the international one because they are more exposed to a diverse range of backgrounds and perspectives and people, and culturally here, there might be a tendency towards, because of the social norming aspect of Dutch culture, you need to sometimes, and this is me possibly being wrong, and I'm wrong all the time, but it could very well be that if you don't move in a certain way, speak in a certain way, meet a certain number of criterion, your voice will not be heard as loudly as someone that comes from one background or another, or has one relationship with someone or another, or there's some sort of connection in terms of social. Like, I'm speaking as a first generation immigrant here, like I'm, as you can tell by my thick Dutch accent, I'm a Canadian. You know, I came out here, and maybe this is a chip on my shoulder that most first generation immigrants feel like they need to come and prove themselves and show demonstrate why they need to be here. Or at least that's my two cents worth.
Well, if you go down that road, that definitely plays a role, but it has been playing a role since I moved to the Netherlands.
Right.
And I'm sure that it impacts also the relationship or communication that I have with people here in the Netherlands as well.
Yeah. Because
I've never experienced what I experienced here in the Netherlands. I do experience it outside the Netherlands because of the color of my skin, but not to the extent. But again, I live here.
Yeah.
But still, the intensity that it happens here is much, much higher. If I'm at an event outside of the Netherlands, people would not generally think that I'm a waiter at an event, because they would see me and they would somehow know that all the waiters are dressed in black. And though I'm not dressed in black, here in the Netherlands, people still assume that I'm the waiter.
Because you're black.
Yes. Or I tend not to stand close to doors, because literally I just don't want to get myself upset that people would stand and expect me to open the door because I'm standing a bit close to a door.
Seriously?
I'm very serious. I'm very serious. Yes.
That's so fucked up. That is so fucked up.
I'm aware of the fact that I often give presentations here in the Netherlands as well.
Yeah.
I'm just aware of the fact that when I enter the room, that the people present, I can just imagine them, their minds moving all the way, all different directions. Who's he? What is he doing here actually?
Mm.
But it doesn't bother me. And that's the demeanor, the arrogance that I have, that I know I'm here because you asked me to be here. And if I don't feel comfortable, I will leave.
Good. Right?
Yes.
As you probably should. But is this, this is just stems purely from my total ignorance. But is this a chicken and egg situation? Is this... Do you go in there knowing?
No.
Okay.
No, it's not. I sometimes when speaking to friends about my experiences, I often just say, if I was supposed to be telling you everything that happens in a week, you would be amazed. But I thank my upbringing to some extent that I don't let it get to me, because I don't feel dependent on anyone.
Mm.
And I don't let anyone give me the feeling of being insecure or anything like that. So,
right.
Just recently, but I was not in the Netherlands, a couple of weeks ago, literally, we were in Portugal at a private party. And, I was standing my partner was to the left, a friend to the right. And the waiter comes up, because again, it's a private party on a beach. Everyone's dressed in white. And the waiter comes with the welcome drinks, champagne, gives my partner a glass of champagne, literally stands in front of me, walks beside me, gives our friend to the right a glass of champagne, and walks off. So their reaction were like, he didn't give you anything. So I started laughing. I said, oh yeah, I know. But I said, This is what I often try to explain. This happens so often at events. I don't take the time. I do not want to take the time to wonder or question why. And what I did at that time, what I usually would do, is question myself. What is it will I achieve at this moment if I was supposed to verbalize something? And what is it going to cost me? And based on the answer that I get, then I react.
So you actually have to go through like a cost-benefit analysis of whether or not you should say something. But either way, they all those situations, do they bother you? Honestly.
Honestly,
you then make the choice afterwards to say whether I should make a stink about it. But as a human, another human to another human.
Yeah. I think just a bit ago, I said I said what I was going to say about my upbringing. The positive side of my upbringing that my father would always say, no one is better than you guys. They can feel less if they want to, but that's up to them, but they're not better. Then I come back to arrogance.
I don't know about that.
Maybe it's not arrogance. Okay,
it could be interpreted as arrogance.
Self-respect.
Yes.
I respect myself. I got from my peers. But on the other hand, it also allows me more often than not to just let things go. Because I more often than not decide it's not worth my time. Someone would say, like with this last experience that I just mentioned, well, why don't you say something so that the person realizes that they did something that's just not right? My reaction, first reaction was, I'm not here to teach him what he's supposed to be doing. I'm not going to see him anymore. Who cares? But then afterwards, I did mention it to the person who organized the party because I was like, it's just not fair. Not mention it because it's probably going to happen to someone else. And that gets me upset. If I see it happening to someone else, it would get me upset. I know.
So you're fine with it happening to you?
Well, fine is fine. It's not fine, but I can deal with it. Because knowing also if I'm in an ability situation where I decide I'm not accepting this, but also, it's on the other hand, I always like question very fast in my mind, what is going to cost me? What am I going to get from it? And along the same line, I don't usually get upset very fast, which annoys me afterwards because I just feel primarily reacting, it's just like that. It's not in my nature.
So how did you come up with that matrix, that decision-making, decision tree, if you will, about whether or not to say something? Where did that come from?
I don't know. I try to think back on my upbringing and see what elements maybe I've gotten from my father or my mother. Because the way I think it's across the board with everything that I do. You reached out to me, and the moment I read the email, it just automatically happens. If I decide to take a trip, I am quite boring, actually. I'm always thinking strategically, trying to come up with a strategic decision.
And has that affected?
Nothing I do is just random.
So it's all structured and planned. But how do you deal with inspiration then? How does, when coming up with companies and coming up with ideas to, or problem solving, problems that need solving, if it's all strategic, how do you reconcile that, the structured nature of your decision making with the somewhat creative inspiration side of what speaks to you to do something and get behind?
I have an answer for that. Because of the chaos that we live in, right? I have been able to find structure within the chaos. And that is how I'm able to be creative. Because I do not experience chaos as chaos. if there's chaos, I am automatically find a structure within that chaos that will help me, will guide me, something that I can hold on to. So even being trying to be creative or being creative and seeing being trying to solve problems, if I go to a cafe or a restaurant, I automatically see how the waiters or let's say interacting with the customers, and I would be then thinking about missed opportunities. But it's not an automatic process. But within the chaos, there is structure. And I often, when I'm doing something, I often like to present it as chaos, knowing that it's structured. If I give a presentation, I'm not worried about giving the presentation because no one knows what I'm going to be saying. So it could be chaotic, but I make sure that it's structured and the audience have no idea that it's chaotic because they feel this. I make sure they follow this line that I want them to follow without them knowing that they're following this line that I've set out for them to follow. You understand what I mean?
So does that, yeah, no, exactly. But that, where does that come from though? Has that ability to manage chaos helped you in any way in some of the more challenging moments in your life?
No, because there's one challenging moment in my life where it worked against me. And that was when I was diagnosed with cancer. Prior to my diagnosis, I was convinced that I had cancer. And so prior to my diagnosis, I was already trying to structure that, to plan it. When I got my diagnosis, literally, I came home and made a plan. I made a plan that included how long I was supposed to be grieving and when I was supposed to be up and running again. And that plan did not work
out. Yeah, I was going to say, how did that plan pan out? How much of that plan did you get done?
None. And only when I was able to some extent, try and let go of that feeling that I had to be in control, that I was a bit more in control. I wanted to plan everything. I wanted to plan if I felt sad, I would give myself literally like a couple of minutes. And then if the moment I feel as if I'm getting sad, I was like, and I do that also in general life. That's why I don't usually get upset, because the moment I start feeling that I'm getting upset, my mind tells me, now you've realized that you're getting upset, you know why you're getting upset, there's no need to be upset anymore. Yeah.
So that, wow. Does that come from, so what typically from what I've seen or heard at least, does that stem from a sense of, are you afraid of something? Are you afraid of not being in control?
This is going to be very therapeutic.
I mean, yeah, seriously, I'll get to send you my bill later.
Yes. Am I afraid of not being in control? The answer is yes. Yes, I'm definitely afraid of not being in control because my whole life I've tried to be in control, knowing that it is impossible to be in control of everything, of most things actually. But yet I have this feeling that I am in control. And so the idea of not being in control is scary to me because I have no idea how I will react.
So you embrace the chaos, but thrive on order.
Yes. Yes. You said that really perfectly. You were in Amsterdam and biking, I tend to stop at every traffic light. And if I don't, I feel guilty. Yes.
I mean, yeah, it's kind of the rules, right?
Yeah. But yes, I feel guilty every time I would bike through a red light.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Now, there are people like you.
Yeah.
What I was curious about, one of the last few things, I want to be conscious about your time as well. Yeah. One of the things that I'm curious about is if you were to talk to 25-year-old Robert, mm-hmm. what would you tell him?
I would tell him to live a little. Don't think, live a little, Robert, and don't think, take things too serious.
And what do you think 25-year-old Robert would say to 30-year-old Robert? Today's Robert.
He would probably say, this works for me, so I'll continue doing it this way.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's always...
He would definitely say that, and he'd say, I'm not asking you to change, so don't ask me to change.
I hear a little bit of mom in there. I made my decision. I made this choice. Get the fuck out of here.
You can't convince me to do it differently. I'll stick to this.
I mean, there's something liberating about making, owning, and moving on from a choice, right? Or at least that sort of spills into making and deciding on a structure within chaos as well. There's some freedom in the order that it empowers you to breathe and thrive and do things, albeit within a structure. It lets you get back on that bike and enjoy biking.
Yeah.
You know, and you're not going to get hit by a car.
That's true. It takes away also, in my opinion, it takes away a lot of fear.
Yeah.
About things, about doing things, trying stuff, etc. When I was organizing an event with a hotel here in Amsterdam, I remember sending an invitation to, she was there, Princess Maxima. And just getting a reply back felt great. I sent an invitation to the ambassador of Sweden and he agreed to attend. And after looking back, I would be like, if I sat for a moment and thought this would be impossible, I would never have done it. But I'm like, who cares?
Right? So you do take risks. I think this is actually what I'm getting at here is that one of my earliest explanations of what an entrepreneur is, someone who takes calculated risks, someone who thinks about the choices, albeit within a chaotic environment or within a space of uncertainty, but still makes that qualitative leap into a new state of being, existence, of doing, and then structures their own path within that scope. It's the adage or analogy I've said before where an entrepreneur is someone who jumps off a cliff and builds an airplane on the way down.
Yep.
And it sounds like you've got this really beautiful, really interesting and really not chaotic, but somewhat ordered, but very diverse and fluid and interesting flow that brought you to where you're at today. And through that flow, through that, the ebbs and flows and shifts and shocks and changes and everything, you've managed to find your own niche of connecting with people, with yourself, mm-hmm. with the world around you, while at the same time creating your own breathing space that allows you your own room to grow and develop and expand your understanding of the world around you. Do you think this, does that make sense? Is that?
Yes, it makes a lot of sense. And that's how I also portray entrepreneurship. I would never tell someone, if I'm giving a presentation, whatever, I would never tell someone everything's possible if you work hard enough. Or you just need to try. I would never do that because I don't believe in it. We can't all be successful. What I do think though, I really believe in is that being an entrepreneur means often that you are willing and you want to do things differently. You want to do things most sometimes that has never been done before. It means you're in a unique space. A unique space means a lonely place because it's hard to find people who will understand where you want to get to, because it's a unique idea that you have. So people not generally understand that. What I do often tell people, especially in the past, is try and be surround yourself with people who don't care actually what you even want to be doing, but care about you. And willing to let you discover your path that you want to just be taking and support you in that. Be it that you're successful, whatever successful could mean, or be it that you fail, which I don't really believe in, that you can actually fail. Because who cares?
Yeah, that will be the quote of this session, that's for sure. I really like that. I think that's beautiful. I think that speaks to a lot of what a lot of people go through. That loneliness too, that being in that very lonely space, how do you keep pushing through? How do you keep on, like, if you're alone, you're the one that's going to be your own cheerleader, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep getting at it?
Well, at the end of the day, I'm doing stuff or try to do stuff because I feel that it can be impactful for others. I'm not sure, but I get the feeling and think that I have a duty to try, not to the world, but to myself. And at the end of the day, for me, and when I was diagnosed with cancer, that feeling grew even more intense, is that I need to be happy with me. And being happy with me means once in a while also being unhappy. But that makes it all be the feeling of happy more understandable. That's how I do it. I'm doing it for me, and I would love the support. I enjoy when people tell me, wow, the work that you've done is wonderful, really great that you're doing that. It does not uplift me to the extent that it's what I need. But I do enjoy it. And some people, again, might think, well, you should be grateful that people are being grateful and thankful. I am happy. I'm not grateful. I'm happy that they say wonderful and positive things. But I'm doing this because of me.
Right. I'm not doing it to get your applause.
No.
No. But that also is part and parcel of what makes people in entrepreneurship real entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I believe
it has a big play in it. Anyways, well, thank you so much for taking the time today, my friend, for chatting and diving deep in the depths of life, the universe, and everything.
Yeah,
I learned a lot of really awesome things about you, and I'm grateful.
It's been a pleasure, and it helped me as well, because it's sometimes great to hear what's really sometimes hidden deep down inside. So,
well, you got a fan in me, my man.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time today, and I'll keep you posted about, you know, how the podcast develops and stuff like that afterwards. But again, you've been a legend. If there's anything that you want to leave people with, that a thing they should check out, a site or a quote or something that's inspired you, what would you like them to leave hearing from Mr. Robert Green?
Something that just comes to mind now is that today is just today. So today is just today. So it's up to you to do whatever you want to do today.
Brilliant. Amazing. All right, my man. Have yourself a beautiful day today.
I will.
And I will speak to you real soon.
Yeah.